Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Division will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started and try to move through the agenda as quickly as we can. I know people are anxious to hit the road and get home if they're able to after this is over. But I think everyone, except for one person on our agenda, was able to be here today. We're going to start with the Bowser overview, and we'll welcome you to the table. And please proceed. Please introduce yourself. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is John Jasky. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I've been in that position for about a month now. So Doug Thomas will be reviewing our budget, and I will be also here for the later items on the agenda to respond after the OLA gives their presentation. So with that, I'll turn it over to Doug, and he'll begin the budget overview.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Thomas, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I will do my best today to try to be as efficient as I possibly can. You have a black three-ring binder in front of you, and in that has our PowerPoint presentation, and that's what I will be working off of so you can follow along on that PowerPoint presentation. Basically, what we hope to do today is four quick things for you, is give a little bit of background on the agency purpose and our business model, provide you with a quick overview of the major programs that we operate and some of the things that we do to ensure, to show you how those are administered, go through the governor's recommended 08-09 budget, and then wrap up with the change items, which are the things that are different than what we had in the base the last couple bienniums. Very quickly, moving on to slide three, agency purpose. Unique probably to Bowser than any other state agency is our mission is to really protect and enhance soil and water resources on private lands. Key thing there is the acknowledgement that 78% of the state is private ownership. We're going to accomplish our goals of clean water, clean air, abundant wildlife, and productive soil. We need to really focus a lot. Not going to be able to accomplish that by just managing under the control or jurisdiction of the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Thomas, can you move
it's
your
cutting,
microphone
it's
closer,
cutting in
please?
And out.
Excuse me.
It's hard to hear you right now.
Is that better?
Well, just move it as close as you can.
Okay.
Yeah.
Moving on to the next slide in terms of the kind of the key roles that the Board of Water and Soil Resources play. We're primarily responsible for implementing three major policy acts in the state of Minnesota. One is the soil conservation policy, which dates back to the 1930s with the creation of our state soil and water conservation districts. A number of comprehensive water management acts, which date back to the 1950s, as well as the Wetland Conservation Act, which was passed in 1991, which expanded wetland protection from the current DNR protected waters and protected waters wetlands to all wetlands statewide. Moving on, board representation, just to say a little bit about our board. It's a 17-member board. It was created in 1987. It was created as a result back then of a merger of three predecessor boards, the Old Soil and Water Conservation Board, the Water Resources Board, and the Southern Minnesota River Basin Commission. So those were merged together, and Bowser was created in 1987. Those 17 members, as you can see, are spread across the state geographically. We're required by law to do that. And the board is made up of three county commissioners, three soil and water district supervisors, three watershed district managers, three citizens, and the five agencies, DNR, Pollution Control Agency, Department of Ag, Health, and U of M, which are voting members on the board. And again, then we have statutory oversight and responsibility for the state's 91 soil and water districts, which are statewide coverage, the state's watershed districts and water management organizations, which is kind of unique to the metro area, and then 87 counties as they're engaged in local water management in the administration of the state's Wetland Conservation Act. I just want to mention very briefly some of the partnerships which we're engaged in. In addition to the five agencies, and we do a tremendous amount of work in collaboration with the DNR, the PCA, the Department of Ag, and Department of Health, and the university, but in addition to that, we have formal working agreements with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers implementing the Army Compatible Use Buffer project up around Camp Ripley, the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service on a number of programs, most notably the Wetland Reserve Program, Farm Services Agency, that's, you know it probably as CREP, where we take RIM and CRP, the Department of Army, and then the Department of Transportation for the replacement of road impacts to wetlands that are done because of safety and road improvement projects. Just very quickly on our staff, we have 70 staff located in 8 field offices. 48 of those staff are paid through general fund. The remainder of their staff is funded through RIM bonding fees and federal contribution agreements to pick up the rest of those. And just the 4 functional areas that we're organized around as far as our implementation and our staff resources is the areas of land and water treatment programs, our easement programs, technical services, and field operations. The next 2 slides go through a number of the statutory responsibilities that we have, and I'm just going to highlight a couple of those for you. The second bullet on page 8 talks about the private lands conservation programs, and that really is the place that puts Bowser kind of front and center in terms of overseeing and developing our state's private conservation lands programs. The third bullet talks about being a forum for local issues, and again, that's unique in the sense that it provides citizens and local governments through the structure of the board a way to come to present issues and opportunities and to have those brought into the administrative process through the budget and policy development that we do every year within the context of the administration and then coming back forward to the legislature. On the page 9, I just want to point out the third bullet. Again, it's a unique authority to the board, which one which I think is very important, is, again, it provides citizens an opportunity to come to us without going to district court and to basically allow them to raise questions about water law and policy and what people may perceive as conflicts between the different parts of water policy that we have in the state, and we provide a different forum for them to do that. And then can adjudicate those decisions and come up with recommendations and provide those back to the individuals, the legislature, or to the agencies, depending on the nature of the conflict that we're being asked to look at. Our business model, very quickly, a large local government delivery system. Basically, through the efforts of our soil and water districts and our watershed districts, there's over 450 local employees and many more elected and appointed officials. We believe that's a very cost-effective delivery model for the state to deliver state programs where we feel it's important and it's a priority to deal with that through that local system. A small state staff of experienced technical people, the ability through our board to balance some of those local resource needs with state plans and objectives, recognizing that kind of not all parts of the state are treated equal. Resource issues in Cook County are different than Rock County, southeast Minnesota versus northwestern Minnesota. And so our board provides an ability to balance some of those needs as we look at the development of state programs and policies relating to natural resources and conservation. And just lastly, ability to leverage a lot of federal and local dollars through that business model, both at the federal level, the local government level, and landowner level, where landowners are required to financially participate in the application of cost-share projects as an example of that. Moving on to slide 11, I'm going to shift and just hit very quickly for you some of the main program areas of the board. Our first one is an area that we refer to as our private lands conservation program, and it involves 4 things that are funded by the legislature: the state cost share program, feedlot water quality management program, the SWCD general services, and a non-point engineering assistance grant. Those are the 4 kind of major funded programs that make up that activity. On slide 12, we put this in there, it's very busy, but wanted to try to illustrate for you that, in essence, the grants that we provide to local government are contracts for services. And in the case of our general service and cost share grants that we talk about, they're administered through the local 91 SWCDs, which agree to, in that agreement, to prepare annual work plans, designate high priority erosion, sedimentation, and water quality problems. They're required by law to prepare wetland replacement plans, apply annually for cost share, hire and maintain staff, target at least 70% of the funds they get, and undergo financial audits and required to report and a number of things there. And that basically leverages a lot of federal money and accomplishes a lot of on-the-ground treatment, reducing soil erosion, reducing phosphorus runoff, reducing nutrient runoff. And that then leads to ultimately the protection of water quality and the maintaining that long-term soil productivity of both our ag and forest lands in the state of Minnesota. On slide 13, it just emphasizes the point of delivering that conservation. And just for the two-year period that we have the most current reporting for 2004-2005, you can see that 3,200 projects were implemented around the state. The map to your right shows you our ability through our electronic reporting program to show where that soil loss reductions are occurring, and in this case, we're able to show that by minor watershed in the state. And then the numbers, I think, speak for themselves in terms of the total cost, acknowledging the landowner share, the local government share, the state grant portion, federal. It really is a package and a tool that local governments use, our soil and water districts, to work with individual landowners to address those resource concerns on their farms and fields, and resulting in a pretty good buy for the state on financially. The second major program, moving on to slide 14, is our local water management activities. Basically, there's four major water planning acts that fall under this. The Watershed District Act in 1955, the Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act, which mandated watershed planning and management in the seven-county metropolitan area. In 1985, that model was expanded statewide to all counties, although at the statewide level it's voluntary. And in 1987, we added the Metropolitan Groundwater Act, which allows counties in the metropolitan area to prepare, adopt, and implement groundwater management plans. I think the point here to make is that all of these areas have state-approved plans. This is no longer, in essence, a planning program, but an implementation program. Moving on to the next slide, 15, again, to kind of conceptually show for you this idea and kind of contract for services. We do that through what we call a natural resources block grant, and as our appropriation language, as you'll look at that, refers to the natural resources block grant. What that is it's a bundling of assistance for the state resources that go towards implementing the Wetland Conservation Act. PCA provides us pass-through money for individual sewage treatment system, the implementation of that at the county level, the DNR Shoreland Management Act, PCA Feedlot Program, and then local water management planning in the implementation of those plans. That's bundled together in one grant, very efficient process, one application, rather than having to have multiple applications from a local government, allows us to do a lot of coordination at the state level. And you can see in that agreement, the counties agree to a number of things, including the development of a work plan and budget, identifying specific initiatives, adopting and maintaining local ordinances for shoreland and feedlot programs. That's actually a requirement where they statewide, all counties have to have an adopted shoreland ordinance. We make sure that that's there and in place through some of the granting that we do. And then again, I won't go through all of them, but there's a number of objectives that result from the implementation and the carrying out of those activities at the local level. Again, with the end result really of leading towards water quality protection and restoration statewide. Slide 16, again, just shows you a little bit kind of graphically some of the things that are typically reported or accomplished on the local water management side of it. You can see that the grants that we provided in 2004-2005, education projects, resource inventories at the local level, additional monitoring efforts, you know, that go beyond or are complementary to what is being done with the DNR and the PCA through some of their programs, 305 local regulations that were either updated, modified, or adopted during that two-year dealing with local resource management issues, and then many feedlot initiatives for those counties that are carrying out the state's feedlot program, which could be inspections, they could be permits, they could be a number of things relating to specific feedlot operations. And just another example of how we can kind of show graphically, for example, with our feedlot water quality management grants, where those projects are in the state, what kind of phosphorus reduction we're getting from those, and keeping that pollutant out of surface waters, which creates or contributes greatly to excess algae blooms and low dissolved oxygen and a number of the things that we think of as conventional impairments in our surface waters. With RIM reserve bonding, I'm going to, for the sake of time, skip very quickly through this because it is funded through bonding. It's generally not a general funded item. Wanted to mention it because it's the state's single largest private land easement program that delivers a lot of multiple benefits, all the way from fish and wildlife habitat to clean water, as well as protecting erosion, keeps taxes on local tax rolls, and is our means to leverage on programs like you hear about with CRP and CREP or with the Wetland Reserve Program. On slide 18, I just put this in there because I think it provides a very good focus to the idea that we're really focused with a lot of these on what happens at that farm level, making sure that we're able to address or help those landowners address the resource management concerns on their farms. And this gives an example of maybe how some of these projects fit together, where it's terraces that might be state cost shared, a RIM easement that might be a wetland restoration, abandoned well sealing, a grassed waterway, kind of get a visualization of maybe how that might look out on the land. And then slide 19, again, just shows the total accomplishments with the RIM program over the years and some of the acreages by type in terms of marginal cropland that's been taken out of production and protected, 67,000 plus acres of riparian buffers, over 81,000 acres of wetlands restored through that program. Just gives you a sense of some of the accomplishments there. And the Wetland Conservation Act, moving on to page 20, that's a regulatory program. And I just want to point out the three-way, basically, partnership that the state created with our state's Wetland Conservation Act. One, it's implemented by over 340 local units of government, state oversight and dispute resolution and appeals by Bowser, enforced by DNR conservation officers. That's worked very well, I think, to put that kind of package together to address our state's wetland protection efforts. We also, on page 21, we cooperatively with the University of Minnesota staff a state soil office, which looks at how we continue to increase the usefulness of the soil survey data that we have in the state, updating the outdated surveys that we have, and digitizing current soil surveys. And we have an engineering and technical services section. The last program area that I want to just touch on is the Clean Water Legacy Act. Basically, Bowser, along with the Department of Ag, in the Clean Water Legacy Act that was passed in 07, Chapter 114, is basically identified as basically the lead or one of the co-leads for that non-point source pollution restoration and protection efforts. If you think about that tiered effort of assessment monitoring, TMDL development, non-point restoration and protection, and point source restoration and protection, we kind of fit into that non-point restoration and protection slot. The Act really spoke to restoring impaired waters, keeping waters clean, using existing programs, but looking at bringing new money to the efforts, and required interagency cooperation. Slide 23, again, I won't go through this. It gives you, again, a sense of that kind of contract for services that we enter into. And at the back of your three-ring binder behind tab 3, there's actually one-page summaries of at least six of the projects that were funded to give you an idea of the accomplishments or the activities that will be undertaken, the dollars and the resources. We're actually doing that for every single project that was funded. We've included those as just some examples for you at some point for you to take a look at and consider. Moving on to slide 24, in terms of what did we do with the money that we received last year, which was one-time money, we worked very aggressively with the agencies and created a joint agency request for proposal. That was done in August of 2006. We received 181 proposals that requested over $44 million of assistance for restoration and protection projects statewide. We were able to fund 51 of those projects for a total of just a little over $8 million. 60% of all the funds went for restorations in the 12 TMDL watersheds that have state-approved implementation plans. Later on, when we get to the change item, I'll talk a little bit about the importance of actually we ramp up our implementation based on the number of plans that are approved, and that grows every year with each year that PCA is able to develop, and approve more and more of those local TMDL implementation plans. Just also, again, the significance we talked about last year when we were here in front of the legislature about the leveraging opportunities. We were able to document $6.9 million that's being leveraged with those Clean Water Legacy grants, and that's coming from local government sources or from landowners through their share of a cost share project. On page 25, it just shows you on the restoration project on the left side, the shaded area, that's where the money went. That's where the TMDLs that have state-approved implementation plans exist right now in the state. And on the right side, it gives you a sense of the kind of a geographic distribution of some of the protection dollars that went out to fund projects that were submitted for helping them protect priority water resources that they identified in a local water resource management plan.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Thomas, just a point of clarification. Twice you referred to the TMDLs as being state-approved. Have they all those plans been approved by the EPA?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, it's actually a two-step part, and I apologize for maybe jumping ahead. Every TMDL first has to be federally approved. It's completed, reviewed by PCA, submitted to EPA, and approved by them. Once EPA approval is given, the state is required to approve an implementation plan, which is actually in addition to the TMDL itself.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Thomas, so the ones you referenced have done both. They've
yes.
been approved by the EPA and also the state implementation plans.
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, that's correct.
Thank you.
And so the map on the left, are you said those are the watersheds that have TMDLs and restoration plans or implementation plans that are underway.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's correct. Actually, if you look at that map, the Minnesota River, which incorporates many of those watersheds that you see in kind of that south central part, has a TMDL that's been approved for dissolved oxygen. Southeast Minnesota, which is nine counties, or basically all of southeast Minnesota, has an approved TMDL for fecal coliform. And then there's some others like the Long Prairie River and the lower Red River, which have ones as well. So basically the shaded areas are covered with a approved TMDL implementation plan, and that's where we directed and prioritized the funding this past year to those areas.
Okay, so that those 51 projects funded, those were all in this area?
Of the 51 projects, I would have to look up the specific number, but 67% of whatever basically, not all 51 were TMDL projects. There was a combination of the TMDL restoration and protection projects.
Okay, so those other protection projects, those you said those are just done independently of TMDLs, or what? Or those are just done pre-TMDLs? How do you identify those?
Yeah. Madam Chairman, basically what the Chapter 114 of the Clean Water Legacy Act basically says is that any water that is not impaired is a water that it fits under the importance of protection, keeping it from becoming impaired and getting to the point where we have to do the expensive TMDL and have that kind of legally binding requirement to begin implementation. So what we did was we went back to those local water management plans and tied them back to that the local government had to identify that the water resource that they were proposing to have activities funded to address those high priority waters in a local water plan, that they said these are the highest priority for protection, the ones that we've identified as either recreational lakes, major stream segments, and we want to do something proactively to try to keep those waters from getting to the point where they become impaired and then have to go through that TMDL process.
So those are all waters that have been assessed?
Madam Chair, the assessment may have happened at the local level, but they may not have necessarily been waters that have gone through the formal pollution control agency assessment process. But many of them have been assessed and may have been found not to be impaired, but yet they may have a trend line locally which shows that it's getting worse, but it maybe hasn't crossed that critical threshold of what the impairment is set for in terms of, you know, milligrams per liter of phosphorus or total suspended solids. And we want to try to get at those and stop those and try to reverse that trend through protection efforts rather than waiting until they become impaired.
So then what I'd like to know is how much more need there is in both of these areas. You said that $44 million was requested, 181 proposals, and just looking on these maps, do you have that? Are you going to get to that when you do your change items about how much could be done for implementation of in areas where there are TMDLs, and how much could be done through protection if you had the resources?
Madam Chair, I will I will try to answer that question when we get to that point. It's maybe not specifically there, but I'll try to answer that at that point in time. Moving on to page 20.
Excuse me, Senator Paraso.
Madam Chair, Mr. Thomas, what are the significance of the four green dots on the left part of this slide? Are those hot spots or?
Madam Chair, Senator Paraso, those are lake basins which have a TMDL completed for them.
Okay, thank you.
So that the one there which is down in southern part of Dakota County is Lake Bilsby.
Good.
Moving on to slide 26, we'll get into the 08-09 budget recommendations that are in the governor's budget. You can see basically what we try to do in this first slide is just give you a breakdown of where the revenue comes from for the budget of $48 million. A little over $45 million is from the general fund, 2.876 from the Environmental Trust Fund, and that includes three projects: our local water planning challenge grants, soil survey updates in the Minnesota River, CREP land set aside evaluation project that we're partnering with USGS on. The fees, just $100,000. It's a very minor amount. Those fees come from fees that we collect on appeals that are made to us under the Wetland Conservation Act, and then costs that we charge for transactions in and out of the state wetland bank, which is part of that private banking program, which helps make the administration of the Wetland Conservation Act more efficient at the local level. I'll mention at this point, and Executive Director John Jaski might touch on a little bit more later on, from a trend line perspective, since fiscal year 02, the agency's had an 11% reduction in our agency operations, and this budget presents a 24% increase over the 06-07 budget that we had. That comes mostly in the areas of Clean Water Legacy, the Wetland Conservation Act, drainage, and then some rent and compensation increases, and I'll touch on those when we get to the change item requests. Moving on to page 27, this just shows you on a graphically the differentiation between the general fund and those other sources. And you can see that 94% roughly of the agency's operating budget does come from the general fund. If you look at on page 28, that revenue by category, 75.8% or $36.4 million goes right back out the door to grants to local government, with 24.2% or $11.6 million going towards agency operations and the technical services that we provide, going back to those statutory authorities and responsibilities that we talked about earlier in the presentation. The next slide, 29, shows you the expenditures of that operating budget, that $11.6 million. Again, you can see that that's probably fairly standard with many agencies. Most of that goes into salaries and benefits, but also IT, information technology costs, travel, professional technical services, and things like that. Page 30, that shows the breakdown of the grant expenditures, that $36.4 million, and it kind of covered those basically as far as the major programs. Clean Water Legacy, $9.7 million in 08 and 09, or roughly 27% of the grants that will be going out are going to go out for that activity. 18% for cost share, 20% for SWCD General Services, and you can kind of see how that works its way around the pie chart on the breakdown of those grant funds. At this point, I'd like to shift into the budget change items and go through those for you. The four items that we have this year in our budget, which are new to the agency, are change items for compensation inflation, Wetland Conservation Act, drainage, clean water legacy.
Mr. Thomas, what was NRBG?
I missed that. Madam Chair, that's the Natural Resources Block Grant.
Thank you.
Page 32, the slide dealing with compensation inflation. The governor's budget includes a 2% increase for employee compensation costs that the agency is expected to absorb or to fund as we look at insurance and salary increases over the next biennium. And then $50,000 for rent increases. We got a pretty good deal out of the Pollution Control Agency here a couple years when we moved our offices from south of the river into the DNR PCA complex. That deal ends this year, and so we're going to have to kind of go back and pay for that. So it acknowledges that as well as some additional rent increases in some of our field offices across the state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Frederick.
Chair, Mr. Thomas, by that deal ending, does that mean that you're going to have to move or that you're going to have to renegotiate rental agreements, or what does it mean?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, no, we're going to still be in the complex over with PCA and DNR. We negotiated when we moved over there basically a 10-year agreement on the cost of the rental space. PCA was good enough because of the one, trying to help encourage the move, but also to make it a little bit more livable for us, waived $50,000 in each year for rent, and so now we need to just pick that back up, and we do have a contract with them for another roughly 8 years.
Thank you.
Facility.
Thank you. Mr. Thomas, I'm just going to go back to that block grant and make sure I understand. Sorry, I missed it if you explain that on the pie chart.
Yes.
Could you just explain how that money is used?
That goes, Madam Chair, that goes back to page 15. The natural again, the Natural Resources Block Grant is made up of a number of items. The money that comes directly to Bowser supports the local water management portion, which is money that is provided on a matching basis to counties to implement high priority actions in their state approved, locally adopted comprehensive water management plans. And so that is a grant that's available to all 87 counties that have that state approved, locally adopted plan. And it's again, it's basically on a cost shared basis. That cost share is determined by a statutory formula which takes into account kind of ability to pay. So the grant that would go to Red Lake County is higher, for example, than the grant that would go to Hennepin County here in the metro area. Going back to page 33 on the Wetland Conservation Act, again, the change item was really an outgrowth of a number of things. One is the request by the governor for the cabinet in Bowser to assess where we're at with the Wetland Conservation Act in terms of the acts moving towards or the ability to achieve that no net loss goal that's in the Wetland Conservation Act. Documented workload increases, a need that we have to start a regular basis of monitoring and enforcing the state's wetland banks. Those projects that are put into the state wetland banking system, where people can come in and purchase those credits to offset losses that they may be conducting as part of a project on their own land, as well as the wetlands that we are replacing to offset those local road costs or those local road impacts that are coming from safety-related improvement projects. Then also the need that we identified this last year to really start getting on top of this whole restoration strategy that we have. We've got, as you've probably gathered, we've got federal programs, state programs, private programs. We're proposing some one-time funding, which would give us the ability then to bring those parties all together over the next year and develop a statewide wetland restoration strategy for the state of Minnesota. And on page 34, just gives you a couple examples of some of the workload that we looked at and evaluated as part of requesting this additional assistance. You can see our appeals workload since 1994 continues to go up, which is an added cost and an added burden on our staff. And then you can also see in terms of the enforcement trends, every time there's an enforcement action, there's a required response on the part of our staff and local government staff to address that enforcement action, develop a mitigation plan, to work with that individual to make sure that order that they've been received is complied with, corrected out on the landscape. And so then to summarize the change item for you, the budget is recommending $500,000 annually to provide additional grant assistance to local governments to address those the increasing cost of violation, monitoring, and enforcement in those high workload areas of the state, which basically, if you were going to draw a line in the state to think about that, it's from Rochester, south of the Twin Cities to Alexandria, and then kind of going north from there where we have a lot of rapid development occurring, both urban, rural, residential, and recreational development, which is where we see the vast majority of a lot of these rapidly increasing enforcement actions and violations occurring. I mentioned the $60,000 for that one-time comprehensive wetland restoration strategy, $60,000 annually to the board to assist us with our tasks of monitoring and enforcing those wetland replacement and wetland bank sites. That actually leverages $60,000 of federal funds through a contribution agreement where we're able to maximize our ability to go out and not only do our work, but also look at picking up some of the federal projects, which they have a similar monitoring and enforcement requirement. And then $500,000 annually to the board for state oversight and technical support for the state to the local units of government that are administering WACA. So that would be money to the board to support our increased costs to provide additional training, technical assistance, going out on technical evaluation panels and helping those higher and more costly, in some cases, violations that we get involved in. Then there's also some statute and rule changes that are coming through parallel to this through Senator Chaudhry's committee, that will matches up with then kind of some of the changes there requiring us to look at some additional increased costs to the agency under the Wetland Conservation Act.
So the I don't think we've seen the policy language yet. Is
that? Madam Chair, that was just approved for drafting, actually not for drafting, but we've drafted it. It's been sent back to the governor's office, and we should be having that out. And on the Senate side, I think Senator Chaudhry has indicated that he was going to or was choosing to be the chief author on the bill on the Senate side.
So is any of this budget tied to the policy changes? I mean, will you be able to do this increased monitoring enforcement without some of the statutory changes?
Madam Chair, they are very closely linked together, and the things that we're talking about in where we are recommending stronger or improved monitoring and enforcement, additional oversight, for example, those all would have to come at an increased cost, as well as just addressing the whole issue of increased appeals. And some of the changes actually provide some additional means for folks that are aggrieved by decisions to bring those back to the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
You said the $500,000, that's a much bigger amount than the other ones, so can you just tell me just a little more detail about how that breaks down?
Okay, the $500,000 that would go to local government would be done. We're looking at $400,000 of that would go out on kind of a challenge basis to those counties with the highest increased or documented increase in wetland activity, wetland workload out there that result from enforcement activities and additional activities that have brought their workload up. Those grants have not been increased for 6 years in terms of the state's share, the state's contribution to helping support that local government activity out there. The money that would come to Bowser basically would be to hire additional staff. Would be one position primarily to help support the additional appeals and enforcement efforts that we get involved in. Sometimes those can be very large, very controversial. A good example recently is we've probably spent 6 months of time in Hermantown, which is just out of Duluth, dealing with a major violation where we've got the Corps, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the state all trying to work out and figure out how to resolve a major violation up in that area. We would have some additional staff, approximately one FTE, that would be devoted to providing additional training opportunities for local governments. That's an area that we have fallen back on, is our ability to have regular training opportunities to assist new staff coming on board to help promote wetland delineator certification of local staff. So basically a number of training and professional development activities. And then three additional staff would be basically additional field staff, which would be there to simply take on and address that growing demand for services that are required of us every time that there's an action that takes place at that local government level, which requires that direct participation by Bowser, things like our technical evaluation panels. There's what's called a super TEP, which is basically they can appeal a technical decision, which requires us to make sure that we have staff available to work with those local governments to address those kinds of appeals, as well as just the growing day-to-day demands that we have under the Wetland Conservation Act for the agency.
Okay.
Some of the outcomes that are expected from the change level increase that we've requested are the ability to have improved data. We've certainly, through the wetland assessment and through some of the other discussions that have taken place in Senator Chaudhry's committee, is we don't have the best data on exemptions, de minimis, the cost of replacements. And again, this initiative, by having some additional resources, will help us begin to develop the ability to generate better data in the future so we can make some of the future policy discussions in a much more informed manner. We're making changes on the policy side, which will result in modest reductions in the net loss of wetlands under the Wetland Conservation Act. They won't go all the way to getting to zero, but they're going to result in some modest gains in that arena. As well as then we're also continuing to pursue improvements in terms of just the administrative efficiency and the regulatory simplification between the Environmental Protection Agency, the Corps of Engineers, the state of Minnesota. And much of that work is taking place through our efforts to develop some memorandums of understanding with both the Corps of Engineers and as well as the Department of Transportation here in Minnesota.
What do you mean by modest?
Madam Chair, I'll take a shot at answering that. The policy that we're proposing, and you'll see hopefully soon, is based on a stakeholder process that took place beginning a year ago. And what we would say is that the results of that stakeholder process came up with some ideas to take steps closer to no net loss. But as Mr. Thomas mentioned, getting all the way isn't practical or possible. And so with our improved approach to hopefully collecting information in the years ahead, we'll also be able to track those with some quantitative measures. At this point, I can't give you quantitative information.
Okay.
Moving on to page 37, the next change item that we have is related to the state's public drainage systems. And basically, the map on your left is shows you all the red lines is kind of the magnitude and the extent of artificial drainage in the state of Minnesota. And so we can see geographically that it's a fairly large impact and obviously has raised a number of issues over the years. For us, this dates back to 2005 when the legislature directed us to conduct a study of the implementation of the grass buffer strip requirement. That was completed in February of 2006. That led to the establishment of a drainage work group, which continued to meet this past year. That work group has made a number of recommendations to enhance the ability of the state and drainage authorities to be more proactive in implementing grass buffer strips, recognition that we have got a real problem in the state with old, antiquated ditch records and the need to develop ways to preserve and modernize those records. That's important from a landowner perspective or citizen's perspective because it's those records that we use to provide public notice to people when there's a proceeding that's going to take place, as well as somebody that wants to just come in and says, I'm interested in buying a piece of property, and being able to find out very quickly, is there a public drainage ditch on that property or not? Because it has an impact on maybe what they are thinking about or wanting to do with that property in the future. And so the change item addresses that in part, as well as then a need to look at updating the state's drainage manual, which has not been updated since the 1970s. And moving on to page 38, I just want to touch on those work group recommendations because, in essence, that is what is driving the change item request. Again, the need to preserve and modernize records around the state, enhancing the authority of our public drainage authorities to implement ditch buffers, clarifying the minimum inspection period, annual reporting requirements, again, updating that manual, establishing a state drainage assistance team to provide kind of that high-level technical assistance to drainage authorities that are contemplating undertaking projects and looking at opportunities to build in water management into those systems rather than doing this traditional normal improvement or repair where those issues aren't taken into consideration. And then, again, with this, there's some corresponding policy language that's moving through. And on the Senate side, that Senate File 642 that's being carried by Senator Sparks that was heard yesterday, Senator Chaudhry's committee passed out of that committee to the Committee of Agriculture, Senator Vickerman's committee. And so that is moving along on the Senate side. And page 39 touches on what the financial recommendations are in the change item. $300,000 per year to Bowser to establish that state drainage advisory or drainage assistance team. And that team then would also update the drainage manual as part of the creation of that. $150,000 one time to the board to prepare state guidelines for records preservation and modernization. And then $500,000 one time in the second year of the biennium to the board to provide matching grants to public drainage authorities to actually help them modernize those ditch records to go through and to go to undertake that process. So that, quickly summarizes what that drainage change item is.
So the third item in Senator Sparks' bill, there's a higher dollar request. Can you explain the difference there? He's asking for $2 million.
Yep, Madam Chair, there is a difference. The bill introduced on the Senate and the House side, the Senate version mirrors what started in the House side of it, and it does include higher appropriations. It includes the $150,000 one time for the records preservation and modernization. It includes $2 million for the records modernization. We think that it's appropriate to do the records preservation in the first year, have that in place, and then in the second year start cost sharing on grants with those local public drainage authorities. In our opinion, you know, $2 million is probably a little excessive in terms of our ability to get that out and get that much money committed in 1 year. We believe $500,000 gets us a good start, and then we can come back and, once we know what we've been able to do, what the demand is there, come back with some additional requests in the following biennium for those grants. And then I think the $300,000 is somewhat consistent, although I think they have that in there identified for updating the drainage manual, but then leave an open appropriation for continuation of the work group and the drainage advisory assistance team. And the way Representative Hansen has described that on the House side is that $300,000 gets you those three things.
The how much of a job will it be to finish this, and how much cost share do you think ultimately will be needed to get the job done?
Madam Chair, the $2 million that you have there is an estimate of what we believe it would cost to have records modernized by all of the drainage authorities that currently don't have electronic GIS-based modern ditch records.
Okay, So you're just doing it one quarter at a time.
Madam Chair, in essence, yes. Moving on to the next page, some of the outcomes that we expect from implementation of this initiative is within a five-year period of time, having 75% or more of drainage authorities having those modernized records, having the drainage manual updated in 2 years to bring in a lot of the current information that we have, both on environmental benefits and some of the new technology that is coming out of the University of Minnesota on new ways and new design techniques on how to build water management back into our public drainage systems. Creation of the team would be established, obviously an increase in the number of miles of ditch buffers. That goes back to the policy piece where we're providing some enhanced authorities for drainage authorities to call for order and get the buffer strips implemented where they determine that there's a need for water quality purposes or for making sure that those ditches are preventing some of the future maintenance by getting that buffer strip installed out there on those ditch miles that do not have a requirement for that to date. And then improved enforcement of the buffer strip requirement where it does exist as well. Moving on to page 41, which is a clean water legacy piece of our budget. Just to highlight, the governor's recommendation includes $40 million for the biennium, which includes money in both the Bowser budget, DNR, Department of Ag, PCA, and the Public Facilities Authority. The Bowser portion is $4.45 million per year. And that's a little less. It's about $400,000 less than what we received in 06 and 07. And the categories, though, are very similar in that we're still focused on targeting cost share and incentive payments for non-point restoration in those watersheds with TMDL-approved implementation plans, $2 million a year for restoration, engineering, and technical assistance. We know that we have a tremendous backlog right now in the state on technical assistance. USDA alone with its federal programs is telling us that it's anywhere from $3.5 to $4 million backlog of projects out there that we need the technical assistance in those local field offices. Driving this technical assistance out there, increasing that capacity, not only helps implement these dollars, but also goes a long ways towards making sure those federal dollars, those projects are implemented, and we don't run the risk of losing those federal dollars in future appropriations to the state because we're viewed as not being able to get those implemented in a timely manner. $200,000 per year, which is similar to the previous biennium for reporting and evaluation, and that goes back to some of the work that we do with E-Link, as well as work that is actually effectiveness monitoring, and that's the monitoring that's put in place along with the implementation projects to actually have that in-stream or in-lake information so that 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road, we have the ability to not only look at the land use changes and the estimates that we've made for pollution reduction, but is it actually showing up in the water itself? And then there's $1 million in there for non-point protection activities. Everything above the above that is primarily related to restoration. At this point, I'll try to respond, Madam Chair, to the question you had earlier about the need. We basically have done some work trying to estimate the non-point source restoration needs in the state of Minnesota. And we did that by looking again at the number of TMDLs that are completed and have approved implementation plans. To date, that's 12. By the end of this year, by the end of calendar year 2007, we expect that there will be 27 TMDL projects or areas with approved implementation plans. If we were to start work on those 27 today, say it's a 30-year implementation time frame, that need would be about $24 million per year. That increases each year based on the number of new TMDL implementation plans that are approved by PCA. And PCA is telling us that at the level of funding that they have in the governor's budget of $9 million for TMDL development, that gets about 20 more a year done. So those are some very rough estimates. So what we've basically said is for this biennium, you know, if you were just look at the total need of restoration costs for non-point source, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $24 million a year. And that's assuming that the state pays, that would be 60% because there's some federal dollars out there that we can leverage, as well as the local landowner cost as well. So state need, somewhere in that ballpark of $24 million. As you move into future bienniums, it goes up by basically about $30 million a biennium as we continue to add TMDL implementation plans to the list that are approved.
It goes up by $30 million a year, or it goes up to $30
million? It goes up $30 million basically per biennium.
So if you're adding 20, or how many TMDLs?
We tried to base it on basically a two-year kind of a biennium perspective, and so it'd be in this biennium, it'd be $24 million in 08, $24 million in 09, so $24 million a year. Starting in the next biennium, if you add another 20 completed TMDLs, that number goes up to $54 million. Actually, it goes up to $54 million by the end of the biennium. That's 40 more completed TMDLs. And then the biennium following that, it would go up to $84 million because we'd be adding another 40 TMDLs. And those are some really pretty gross numbers in the sense of, you know, our ability to use other projects that have been done to try to come up with those estimates.
So that would be based on what is in the governor's budget for the PCA to do the TMDLs. If we were to increase that pace, then those numbers would just go higher.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
TMDLs. And this whole the amount of TMDLs that you just mentioned that the PCA will be able to do, that's based on a 30-year timeline to do the whole state?
What we tried to do was with our implementation estimate said if you start implementation, what is a realistic time frame if you were going to complete that work? And we just picked 30 years as a realistic number. We believe that it's, you know, could take that long, particularly in some of the larger watersheds that we have in the state, like the Minnesota River. Lake Pepin's going to be also, it's just a large geographic area.
For the restoration you're talking
about? For the restoration costs, that's correct.
Okay, and then just on page 41, all the list of, the breakdown list you have here, the pieces that you're talking about, are those only the first two bullets, or they include all of these bullets that would go towards that restoration activity that you're identifying as, or is it just the $1 million and $2 million, or $1.5 million and $2 million that's really identified for that purpose?
Madam Chair, the way we look at this in terms of that $5.45 million, basically direct costs for restoration would be the $1.5 million and the $2 million. The $200,000 per year is really built, I think, part of that because it's the reporting and evaluation that we need to do on those projects. And then the $750,000 per year to counties is for the ISTS. That's statewide, but certainly in a lot of areas, if it's a fecal, bacteria, TMDL, correcting and getting rid of non-conforming septic systems or straight pipe discharges, obviously goes a long ways towards restoration. So a big chunk of that would be, I would say, restoration as well. The $1 million for non-point protection is kind of goes back to that whole idea of having resources available statewide to local governments to support some of those activities that are to keep waters from becoming impaired, rather than letting them get to that point and then, doing something about them. And that's really as we look kind of at the northern part of the state where many of our waters, with the exception of mercury, are in good condition, and we want to keep them that way.
Okay, so I'm just trying to do the math here. So roughly, I know you said these are fairly rough numbers, but in your budget request or the governor's budget request, $4.45 million of that would get you on track to restore the wet watersheds which have TMDLs based on a 30-year timeline. And you said that to really do all of the ones that we're able to do, it would take $24 million a year. So basically we're doing about roughly one-fifth of that.
Madam Chair. Yeah, Madam Chair, that's accurate. Our estimate of need is $24 million. The $4.45 million that's in the budget recommendation gets us started and we'll get activities occurring in each of the impaired watersheds or project areas, but probably would not necessarily fully meet the local demand that is there. The other thing is we also have to recognize that there's some ramp up in any of our activities at the local government level to get them going and get them started as well.
Okay, so, but based roughly on what you're suggesting, it would take 150 years to clean up these watersheds rather than 30 years. So this is a 150-year plan to clean up our watersheds.
Madam Chair, doing the math that way, that's correct.
Okay. Well, I have a problem with that, and I hope the rest of the legislature does as well. I hope we can fix that.
Moving on to...
If we were able to get any more resources than what's in the governor's request here,
we'd be further behind.
Which of these pieces would be most important, or basically would you just want to break it down in the same proportion as you have here? Or how would you...
Madam Chair, I think from our priority perspective, we would certainly look at cost share and incentive payments and engineering and technical assistance. Those are the two things that drive those projects getting implemented on the ground.
Okay. And do you think, you mentioned something about capacity, do you think that local governments, do you think you could handle that whole, say it was $24 million a year, would that be possible, or would it need to be a smaller amount in the first initially? And
I think, Madam Chair, I think if you look back to what was applied for, again, we had 181 projects requested over $44 million. So I think that shows and demonstrates that there's a need out there. Of those, I think that split between the restoration and the protection dollars was roughly equal. And so, we're also wanting to make long-term commitments to these projects as compared to one-time funding. So that could change how local governments react and apply for and look at what their needs are to implement those actions that have been laid out in those implementation plans.
And can we assume that all of those requests are, they're all based on an approved plan for restoration, but are they equivalent in terms of their quality, in terms of whether you think they're capable of doing the job well? I mean, I assume you rank these somehow.
Madam Chair, there's really three parts to that. One is, in this budget, there's some money that supports agency staff so that we actually can help, one, develop project proposals so that they are closely aligned with those TMDL implementation plans. And there's other parts of it, you know, whether it's the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Ag, the interagency process that we have to look at accepting these applications, reviewing them, and ranking them and scoring them and funding them is based on a lot of professional judgment of the very things that you mentioned. Capacity, are they targeting the right projects and the right practices based on the professional knowledge? If it's, for example, a phosphorus impairment, you know, are they getting at the things that are going to provide the greatest return on our investment for actually reducing that pollutant out there? So it's a little bit also tied to some of the staff capacity that we're also proposing to make sure that we, along with the other agencies, can do that kind of critical review and make sure that we're funding the best of the best.
Okay, thank you.
And then just some of the key measures to kind of wrap up the Clean Water Legacy discussion, and I think these are some of the things we've already touched upon, is continued funding of this from Bowser's perspective is it'll allow the continued coordination of funding decisions. And I think that's been one of the tremendous success stories that we've had this last year. That interagency process and single point of entry, or RFP, that I talked about, PCA actually brought $1 million of federal 319 dollars to the table. DNR brought some additional forest stewardship grants. And so we basically were able to look at that, work together, and kind of mix and match those funds that we all are individually responsible for administering, so that we were able to really provide a good, solid package, but at the same time reduce the amount of cost and effort that it takes for that local government out there, so that they're applying once. They're not having to apply to four or five different agencies for the same basic project out there. Again, with long-term funding, we'll be able to provide multi-year commitments instead of just 1 or 2 year commitments. I think that's critical as we look at the ability to build capacity at the local level so that they're not afraid to go out and maybe hire some of the additional resource professionals or contract longer term with private sector individuals to provide some of those necessary services that it requires to implement those non-point source projects. We'll continue to strive to have approximately a 70-30 split between restoration and protection, acknowledging that protection is a very important part of our Clean Water Legacy strategy. Continue to utilize and expand our electronic reporting so that we can come back and provide legislatures and others with the measurements of what are these programs, what are these dollars buying, what are the estimated pollution reduction estimates, and how are those actually mirroring themselves in the water bodies or the rivers themselves. And again, with this level of funding, we believe we'll be able to fund some level of implementation in all watersheds that have state-approved TMDL implementation plans. We'll be requiring effectiveness monitoring as part of any award that is made. And then hopefully particularly in the smaller watersheds where the impairment may be just a lake and the watershed might be relatively small as compared to something as large as the Minnesota River, we hope to begin to see waters coming off the list in 5 to 10 years.
Mr. Thomas, you mentioned on the bottom of page 41 the 5 FTEs. And I think you said something about the additional staff needs that you'll have to implement this restoration, this increased restoration work. Where does that funding come from? Are those existing staff?
Madam Chair, the 5 FTE that you see there would be new staff for the agency, and it would be the way the appropriation language, when you see the budget bill itself, actually has some of that staff, one position out of that $200,000 per year for the reporting evaluation is a staff position to support that internally. And then we have some money coming out of the incentive payments and the technical assistance to help us aid in our grants administration, as well as some field positions that I described earlier that will be working directly with project applicants as those projects are developed and are moved forward into the competitive process.
Great. Okay, you mentioned when you were talking about the Wetlands Conservation Act change items, you mentioned you itemized five different staff people, but you're not talking about those staff.
No, Madam Chair, this is in addition to that.
And these would come off of the, this would be taken out of these items on page 41?
Correct.
So five staff. How much of the money then in this is goes for staff out of this $5.45 million of, you know, Bowser staff, headquarters staff?
Madam Chair, the cost that we would put on that would be roughly, when we look at a full-time professional staff, we use $100,000 per year as a rough budgeting estimate. We look at salary, benefits, rent, those kinds of things. So it would be $500,000 of that 5.45 would be going into supporting agency staff.
So with that many new permanent staff, I would think you could support more grant money or more restoration money with that amount of staff. But I mean, but maybe probably not $24 million. Not that I have $24 million to give you. I want to make that clear. I'm just talking theoretically here. What's the range of need? And then we'll figure out what the possibilities are. But what you know, would that take more staff, or that $24 million includes your estimate of staff, I assume?
Madam Chair, at the level that we're talking about, we certainly would not need additional staff with some additional ramp up. Mm-hmm. Clearly, as we look at, for example, grants administration, just what we have to do to process and to do that, we could handle more with the one position that we're identifying here. At the field level, you know, again, we can accommodate certainly a fair amount more, but at some point, as you increase that, it just means that many more projects, that many more you know, projects that have to be monitored and work with, so that we're making sure that that accountability is there, that those dollars are being well managed and well spent. So certainly some additional, without any additional FTE, would certainly be the capacity to be there to do that.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, you know, way back when you first started on page 41, it seems to me you mentioned that you had a 400,000 reduction in the numbers that are represented there. I guess I'm curious, where does that 400,000 come from, unless I misunderstood that, but I don't think I did. And what kinds of reductions then are you suffering in services rendered for that?
Madam Chair, Senator Kubley, the $400,000 that I referred to was the difference between the 06-07 Clean Water Legacy Appropriation and what is being recommended in 08-09. The difference really comes on the protection activities. It's really basically a $400,000 reduction there. Actually, it's a $410,000 reduction there with a slight increase in the ISTS from, I think, last year, the last year of the biennium. Last year it was 740, and it was bumped up to 750.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess the more I listen, the more I'm inclined to agree that, you know, we're going the wrong direction on some of these issues here.
Well, Senator Kubley, the idea that it's going to take us 150 years to clean up the waters of Minnesota on this timeline is completely unacceptable. It's just completely unacceptable. And so we've got to have some more discussion about what to do about that.
Hey, Madam Chair, basically that concludes budget overview, and we're happy to answer any other questions. Again, in the three-ring binder, we did include some additional information for you, a couple fact sheets that are a little bit different format than the change items that you have in your budget book, as well as what we tried to do was provide some examples of three non-point restoration projects and three protection projects that were actually funded with the fiscal year 07 Clean Water Legacy funds that we did receive. So with that, we'd like to conclude and answer or entertain any questions that you have.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Any other questions? All right, thank you. Members, we have a pretty long agenda today. We'll try to get through it. We're going to hear the legislative auditor's report next on Bowser, and I don't know how many members have had a chance to read that, but we'll hear their report, and then Bowser wanted to respond, and then the Association of Watershed Districts and the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, they all wanted to respond to the legislative auditor's report. So we'll get through as much of that as we can, and then we have Senator Vickerman's bill. So we'll start with Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Welcome. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. And with me is David Kirchner, who is a member of the team, and Jan Sandberg, who is also a member of the team, and she'll be making the presentation. Madam Chair and members, I feel like we're going to be the skunk at the garden party, because so far it sounds like everything is just going wonderfully, but it's not. We did an evaluation that determined that some of the local entities that are managing watersheds are not doing an effective job. We don't think Bowser is adequately holding them accountable. What I think the presentation that you just heard from Bowser demonstrates is that Bowser does a lot of things, and we didn't look at all of them, but we looked at one very important thing, and that is its relationship with local entities in managing watersheds. And that's where a lot of the problems with water quality start. And that's where we need to address those issues. And it's controversial. It's difficult because it principally involves land use. We believe that local units of government have to be involved philosophically and practically. There's got to be a lot of local involvement. But we think that the presentation that you just heard shows that there are a lot of state goals and objectives and interests involved. So these issues are not just local, they're state. And ultimately, the state has a responsibility to protect our water. And so the question arises, when local watershed management entities become ineffective or dysfunctional, what are we going to do about it? Really, it should be Bowser that should be involved before the problems get out of hand. Bowser should not simply be standing on the sideline. Bowser does a good job of distributing money and establishing partnerships with local entities, but we found that it has not done a particularly effective job of setting performance standards and holding entities accountable. So that's going to be our message. We apologize. It is a somewhat more negative one and critical one than you've heard so far, but we think to really accomplish the objectives you want to accomplish, you have to address the reality. And the reality has some problems with it, some problems in governance, accountability, and oversight. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn to Jan Sandberg to make a presentation of our evaluation.
Okay, thank you. Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Jan Sandberg. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. And just a note, I can't remember if Jim mentioned, we also had John Patterson, who was a member of our team, but he is no longer with us. He's moved on to the executive branch. Well, I'm going to briefly run through this for you. I'll go as quickly as I can and hope be understandable to you, because I know the weather is not being totally agreeable today. But we'll go quickly. If you haven't read our report, there is a summary, as usual, in the first few pages. I think they're blue. That might help. I'll quickly summarize our key findings that we had in our report. First, Minnesota has a complex and sometimes confusing system of federal agencies, state agencies, local governments that are involved in managing our watersheds. And among those local entities, we found a mixed record of performance, and we believe there is inadequate state oversight of them. I'll describe our complicated structure with this very simple map. To begin with, you know Minnesota's 87 counties, obviously. I'll overlay our 81 watershed districts on them, and you see what might be part of the problem. In Minnesota, the Department of Natural Resources defines a watershed as an area of land. It's an area of land that drains into a lake or a stream. They can be very small, a few square miles that drain into a stream, or it can be as large as the part of the United States that drains into the Mississippi River. Jim mentioned that Watersheds are important because what we do in them, what we do on the land, whether it's farming or construction, is going to impact the quality and quantity of the water that flows into those lakes, streams, and rivers. And as you can see from this kind of confusing overlap, what it essentially means is that a watershed can take in parts of many different counties, and conversely, a county can touch in many different watersheds. And this can create some complexity and confusion and require coordination when you're doing planning. I'm going to briefly review the four major types of local government entities that are involved in watershed management, and I mean briefly. We'll start with the ones that are based on a watershed basis. We have in blue the 46 watershed districts in Minnesota. They're scattered throughout the state. In orange, the 23 watershed management organizations in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. In Minnesota, our watershed districts are, in fact, formed in response to a local petition. Their boards are appointed by the counties. They have levy authority. They also have the ability to make rules and enforce them. They have most of the tools they need to address water problems within their boundaries. Now, by state statute, the Twin Cities metropolitan area, every sub-watershed within it, must be under the oversight of either a watershed district or a watershed management organization. These WMOs, though, are joint powers organizations. They're made up of this usually cities and towns within their boundaries. And while they have some of the same goals and purposes as a watershed district, they generally lack levy authority, and they usually serve more of a coordinating function with the actual work on the ground being done by the cities and towns. On a county basis, we have two other types of entities. In Minnesota, we have 91 soil and water conservation districts, 91 rather than 87, because five counties have broken themselves up into more than one SWCD. These entities have an elected board, but they have no levy authority. They are pretty much funded by their affiliated counties. They get some money from Bowser. Sometimes they get grants. They often are engaged in educational work, and many of them work with landowners doing what they're called best management practices. These are activities that are designed to improve water quality or perhaps affect the flow of water off the land. And in outstate counties, and I think this refers to something Bowser mentioned, they are by state law encouraged but not required to have water plans. But I think they all do, primarily because they can access certain funds that way. And as you can see from, next slide, I'm going to not talk about Bowser because I think Bowser talked about what they do, and I think you understand that fairly well. Other state agencies that are involved: Pollution Control Agency, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, and a few others. At the federal level, U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Army Corps of Engineers, and others. So the big question here, we think, for most people is, how well are we doing? Are we improving our water quality? Are we reducing the risk of flooding? How's Minnesota doing? And we can't tell you. And here's why. I do have an answer for this. As you know, the Pollution Control Agency is charged under the Clean Water Act with assessing the state's waters. They assess them to determine if they're polluted. If they're polluted, they're called impaired waters. And they tell us that about 40% of Minnesota's waters that have been assessed are, in fact, impaired for aquatic life or recreation. However, a fairly small proportion of the waters have, in fact, been assessed to date. I think about 4% of the lakes have been assessed for aquatic recreation. Now, we talked to PCA scientists. They told us they will finish the assessments eventually, and when they do, they anticipate about 40% of waters statewide will be impaired, and that these will be in watersheds virtually throughout the state. We also found that we do not have good data on flood risk statewide. There are not flood maps in some parts of the state. In some other places, they're 10 to 15 years old. So we can't tell you how well we're doing statewide because we don't have good statewide data, and we don't have it over a long enough period of time to calculate those kinds of trends that would see if things are getting better or worse. There is another reason, though. In Minnesota, we mentioned before we have those four types of entities, and there are lots of others, by the way. I didn't mention lake conservation districts, lake associations. They're in our report to some extent. We won't go into detail. There's too many of them. But in Minnesota, the state relies on those local entities to do a lot of the local work that's done on the ground. They are, in fact, the implementers at the local level. Yet we found that there is no statewide collection of data on what they're doing. We don't have a statewide collection of work plans or anything similar that would give us an idea of what's going on in a lot of those different local entities. So since we did not have statewide data, we did a series of 15 case studies. This map kind of illustrates where they were. We did some counties, SWCDs, I think they're in yellow. We did watershed districts in the blue. The WMOs are in the orange. And the greens are two joint powers organizations that kind of cover watersheds. And then we did one unorganized watershed. Details about eight of those are in the appendices to our report. We combined two of them, so there's only seven appendices. And we have details about the others that are not in the report. If you're interested, I think I gave Mr. Jarofsky copies of them in an envelope if you're interested, or ask me. And what we generally found was, looking at these case studies, is that essentially the performance was, we call it mixed, which might be a kind term, I don't know. We found some entities doing quite well. We found others that we called struggling. I'll just highlight a couple of these. In central Minnesota, the Sauk River Watershed District has worked with the Stearns County SWCD over a period, I believe 8 years at least, to reduce the level of phosphorus in the Sauk River chain of lakes nearly in half. In Hennepin County, the Bassett Creek Watershed Management Commission has worked with the Corps of Engineers, among others, over I think at least the last decade or so, to implement a variety of flood control and management projects that in 2003 were estimated to avoid $10 million, I think, in flood damage from a single flooding event. However, outside the low-performing entities, the South Two River Watershed District, some of you may have heard of this, is a district in central Minnesota, about 20 years in existence. And during that time, no major projects and fairly few activities. Citizens petitioned the Board of Water and Soil Resources last year to terminate the district, which they agreed to do, and I think that just got finished, the final steps, just a few weeks ago. The Upper Rum River WMO in Anoka County is one of those coordinating oversight kinds of entities, yet when we looked through their minutes and other documents, we found no evidence that they did any kind of coordination or oversight at all with their members. And I want to emphasize to you that it's important what these local entities are doing. I mentioned that the state relies on them, and it does. In Minnesota, these are the entities that are doing the work on the ground and getting most of the work done. The state has decided that this is how they're going to divide things up. We do not have the state agencies going out and doing most of the work themselves. It is the local government that does it. So we think that the state has a reason to need effective watershed management, and yet we found that some of this is inconsistent. In some cases, it's not being well done. Now, as you know, the legislature of the last century has consistently found that the public waters are something to be regulated and protected. It's in the public interest to do so. What happens in one part of the state often has an impact, possibly in a location many miles away. An example of that is the Lake Pepin situation, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Lake Pepin's a natural lake in the Mississippi River. It sits at the bottom, as this map shows, kind of at the bottom of three major river basins. So what you have is lots of local decisions in each of those basins filtering down, impacting Lake Pepin. In 2005, the State Court of Appeals blocked the Pollution Control Agency from issuing a permit to construct a new sewage treatment facility that would serve the cities of Annandale and Maple Lake. The reason was that facility would have added phosphorus into the watershed. So now we have a situation where lots of local decisions have come together to essentially potentially block or hinder development of a fairly large part of the state. And we think that's a problem. Now, I mentioned before we found some cases of inconsistent and poor performance. Next question is, so what are we doing about it? Who's looking at it? Who's seeing what's going on? Bowser is the lead agency, the key agency that has responsibilities for overseeing local management entities. Yet we think that this has not been done in any kind of systematic fashion. Frankly, we have not seen the establishment of any performance standards, systematic monitoring of performance, or holding these local entities accountable when their performance has been weak. Now, we looked at, as Jim said, Bowser's oversight roles fairly intently, and we found two reasons we think probably can explain part of this. First of all, we flat out think they don't have the statutory authority they need. Particularly outside the Twin Cities metropolitan area, Bowser has very few tools that it can use when somebody isn't implementing their plan or doing a good job. Now, Bowser's role is really in looking at those plans and approving or disapproving of them. But once it's approved, they can't go back and see why parts of the just approved plan aren't being done or being planned for in the near future. However, even in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, where Bowser has considerably more authority, we found they really aren't that interested, or we could say they were reluctant to exercise that authority. In our case studies, where we found weak performance, in fact, we found some involvement in planning, but very little interest in what was going on with the implementation of a plan. With the Upper Rum River, for example, Bowser has, to their credit, been active working with that entity, trying to get them to strengthen their plan. Yet we could find nothing that indicated in the 10 years previous, since their 1997 plan, they had attempted to step in and work with Upper Rum River to get parts of that plan implemented. And we think that's... Now, there is another way that you can have oversight, and in fact, this does happen in the state. PCA, DNR, and even Bowser have competitive grant programs, and those programs actually require the entity receiving the grant to report how they've spent the money, maybe even if set some performance standards. And that's a good mechanism. The only problem is not all entities get grants. And in fact, they can choose how accountable they want to be. Since some entities, like watershed districts, have levy authority, they often don't need those grants for their operating funds. And what's even more interesting is to actually win a grant, to get a grant, generally it means the organization is doing a pretty good job. They have a track record. So you have this kind of interesting situation where the most successful organizations are being held to the strictest standards, and those who choose not to apply for the grants or don't get them actually have lower standards. And frankly, we think all local management entities should be held to strict standards. Why now? Why is this such a big deal now? Well, you just were talking about it, and you had a lot of questions about it. We have this Clean Water Legacy Act people keep talking about. Last year, it was one-time money. But this year, I think the governor, $40 million per year? And I've heard some discussion in some of these parts about something called a constitutional amendment that might have a clean water account to it, which I suspect will be even more money. A lot of this money is going to go to these local entities because they're the ones doing the work. And nobody's suggesting that anybody gets rid of them and have this work done by state agencies. They're going to continue doing the work. We think the time is absolutely right for the state to have an interest in getting more accountability, having them do a good job. And frankly, we need accountable entities statewide. These impaired waters are not just a problem in a couple of parts of the state. So we have some recommendations. First of all, we think that the legislature will need to require Bowser to establish performance standards, which could vary by type of entity. We think that Bowser should be collecting performance data, collecting financial data, then monitoring those local entities to see how well they're meeting the standards. And frankly, we think it would be useful if some of these assessments were made public, because some of these entities are quite visible almost to local citizens, counties, and perhaps even to some of the legislators in whose districts they lie. We have a few other recommendations. First, we think you need to give Bowser a wider range of tools. I mentioned before they have particularly weak oversight on watershed districts outside the Twin Cities metropolitan area, but frankly, we think their authority overall should be improved. And we also recognize if you're asking an agency to do more, you may have to give them more resources. And finally, and we know this is controversial, we believe there are changes needed to Bowser's governing structure. I believe it was mentioned before, they have a 17-member board. That board is a governing board. That's somewhat unusual. In fact, I think it's highly unusual in the executive branch. They don't just set policy. They don't just advise. They actually set policy. They select their own executive director. The majority of members of that board, in fact, represent those local entities I described earlier. So we have a situation where local entities are accountable to Bowser, and Bowser is accountable to the local entities, and we think there's a problem with that structure. Now, we are not suggesting that the Bowser board has acted illegally, inappropriately. That's not what we're talking about. This is an issue of philosophy, of whether you're willing to exercise oversight and become involved with those entities at the local level. By the way, this is also not an issue about personalities. It's about structure. We know they have a new executive director. It's not about an individual. We're talking about structural issues, boring though they may be. So we think that Bowser needs to be more accountable. Quite frankly, we think Bowser should be more accountable to you and to the governor, which means the executive director should be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And we also believe that the board should no longer be a governing board, but should in fact become an advisory commission. We know it's controversially. We understand that. But frankly, we don't understand why you would treat water, which is a key responsibility of the state, any different than you treat something like natural resources or transportation, with ultimate accountability to the legislature and to the governor. Madam Chair, that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to answer questions.
Great. Thank you very much for that comprehensive look. Senator Paraso.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sandberg, or Commissioner, what I'm kind of interested in, if you could tell us some of the interesting things that you found where they were going particularly well, because you have some areas that are working better than others. If you could give us an idea of what you might have found. It's in the minority, sure. Obviously, because your recommendations show that the majority is what you reflect in your recommendations.
I think it's safe to say, and David probably has as good information as I do about this, the well-performing entities often tended to spend a higher proportion of their money on implementation rather than administration, and there is some information about that in the report. They often had, I think, full-time staff. To a large extent. I don't think we really documented these things in a sense. David, do you want to add something?
The one thing that I would say...
Can you identify yourself?
Yes, I'm sorry. David Kirshner from the Legislative Auditor's Office. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Paraso, I think the one thing that I would say in response to your question is you suggested that we found that a majority were not performing well. And that's actually not quite the case. What we would say is we don't know, actually, how a majority of – or we don't know how most of the watershed districts and soil and water conservation districts and other local entities are performing around the state because, frankly, nobody is keeping track of them. And that's something that we find to be extremely problematic. We think that Bowser ought to be paying much closer attention in a much more systematic way to what is happening at the local level so that when Bowser comes before you next year or the year after that, they can say, well, we can tell you how many watershed districts are performing well and how many are performing poorly or how many are performing up to the standards that we have set. At the moment, they do not have that kind of detailed information about local entities around the state, and we think they should.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions? Madam Chair. Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I noticed that you like that director appointed by the governor. I'm going to take issue with that because then it gets too political. I'd be a political appointee, and I've been around here a long time, and only once in 21 years have we not agreed to the governor's, confirmed the governor's appointee. So I would have to take, I'd have to take a serious look at that. I'm a person that believes in local control, and we're taking it away if you let the governor appoint the executive director. We lose, I think, some clout. And I might be wrong, but that's my, because I used to serve on that board. It's easy to sit here and say, do this, this, and this, but you try dealing with a bunch of farmers who don't really want you probably on their land in the first place. So it's hard to do that. And I don't know what happened to Lake Pepin, but every time we bring up any kind of water quality or any money to spend, it's always on Lake Pepin. Where's Wisconsin? Don't they own part of that? Is that all our problem?
The other side of the river has probably flowed away already.
Jeez. That's my speech for the day.
Runs so. Faster than Minnesota does.
Senator Torrey
Frey. Madam Chair, I am curious about, I don't have enough background to ask this question, but don't we have a mechanism to do an evaluation of these entities so that we can have some standards, performing standards? Because I'm not necessarily sure that changing the structures of appointing and who appoints and how the board is appointing these individuals actually resolve the problem. I think the issue is how do we actually conduct an evaluation so that they can continue to receive funding, and I think that's our responsibility. I we provide the funding for this entity, so I think we want results. I think the funding should be attached to that, but I don't know if that's in place already, and how does that work?
Madam Chair, members, let me maybe respond to several of the points that have been made. We certainly respect the point of view that it says that local units of government, local control is important in this state. And Senator Vickerman, we certainly respect your point of view on that issue. But, you know, politics is going to be involved one way or the other. The issue is whether it's going to be accountable politics. We think that the structure that we have now does not provide adequate accountability to you or to the public, because who is in charge of Bowser? Who do you hold accountable? Can you hold the governor accountable? You are going to use Bowser, as is the governor, to achieve a lot of statewide objectives, important objectives. But how much control, appropriate control, do you or the governor have over Bowser? Very diminished by the way it is governed today. Now, we realize that Bowser did not create that governance structure. You did. The legislature did. And it was created in the past out of a political compromise that had great validity. We're not saying that Bowser's broken. We're saying that Bowser needs to be better. Bowser needs to be stronger to accomplish the goals that need to be accomplished. And to do that, there needs to be more transparency, more accountability. And you're right, there will be politics in the appointment of the executive director by the governor, and it will come to the Senate if you adopt our recommendation, and you can debate whether you think that's an appropriate appointment or not, just like you do with the Commissioner of Transportation, Commissioner of Health, the Commissioner of Education. You know, and let's stop right there with education. Education is an aspect of state government that involves a lot of implementation through local units of government, local school boards, local superintendents. But do local school boards and local superintendent organizations get to appoint the Commissioner of Education? No, the governor does. And so the citizens of this state and you hold the governor accountable for the performance of that department. And we think that's the model that ought to exist here. Although, as I say again, giving due respect to the point of view that you express. But as to a system of accountability, of evaluation, what I think would be the test, if those who support the current structure think it can work to achieve accountability and oversight, then expect Bowser to produce this report, not the legislative auditor. We laid out for you in black and white who does well and who doesn't. Why haven't you gotten that from Bowser?
Well, and I think there really are two questions. One question is obviously how, you know, it is our responsibility to make sure there's accountability for the job that we have to make sure that our waters are maintained and as clean as they can be, and even more so for the dollars that we're going to put into that effort, and as we're talking about significantly increasing our commitment to clean water funding, we have to make sure we have accountability and results for that money. And so that's the first question. If there's not a system in place to ensure that accountability and ensure that we're getting the right outcomes, we need to look at that. Whether we agree with your suggestions for how to get there, that's a second question. And we can debate what's the best mechanism for achieving more accountability. But I think the first thing we need to do is figure out whether you're right, that there isn't really any kind of performance standard in place, and identify that problem. And if so, then we can get to work and figure out how to solve it in a way that works, you know, for all of our interests.
Madam Chair, I would just like to agree very much that we're here to point to the fact that there is a problem. There are a variety of ways to solve it. But I think, again, I would go back to how I opened my remarks. Absent this evaluation, I think you would have been left with the impression from Bowser that everything is going well at both the local and the state levels. But I think we all know that's not true. In fact, we did this evaluation because legislators asked for it, because many of you in the House and Senate said, you know, in my district, I have a watershed entity that isn't performing well and not anything is happening to get them on track. And so they ask us to intervene with an evaluation. But we're not going to get ourselves to where we need to be with just an evaluation or an audit. Maybe the recommendation that we make for the change in structure and governance of Bowser is one that won't be politically palatable. But I think that the principle that you just articulated, Madam Chair, is the one that we ought not to lose sight of and not let go away just because it's a controversial recommendation. There needs to be better accountability and oversight. You're going to put a lot of money in the future into trying to get results. And so if Bowser says this structure works, hold them to that. In a year or two, have them before you to show you the performance results and the evaluations in black and white that say who's doing well and who's not.
All right. Thank you very much. And let's
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your efforts. Let's give Bowser the first opportunity to come on up and give us some feedback on this.
Wait, I know.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is John Jaske. I'm the executive director of Bowser. It's J-A-S-C-H-K-E. I'm not going to take a lot of your time. I know we get a lot that we could probably say. Certainly, I also wanted to let you know that our board chairman, Randy Kramer, who was on the agenda, was not able to be here today given the weather conditions. He's a farmer from Renville County. And so if you find an opportunity to invite him back at some point for his response on behalf of the board, I think it would be good idea. So
thank you. And I forgot to mention that. And we have a letter from Mr. Kramer here that is in front of all of us that we should give him the courtesy of reading since he wasn't able to be here today. Great. Thank you. Please go ahead.
There are two other items in your packet, Madam Chair, members. The other one is just basically a summary of what I'm going to say, and the other one is a couple of points that we'd like to make about looking forward and moving in the direction of the do better ideas that we think are something we can work on. As I mentioned earlier, when I was up here with Mr. Thomas, I've been in this position for about 4 weeks. I came to the job from the local government level. I worked as a water resources manager in Dakota County. I think one thing I'll say is that when you put up a map of anything that has a large scale to it, sometimes you get the feeling like it's the humans looking at the anthill and not knowing that the ants actually know what they're doing, because if you get down at the local level, sometimes you can see that there are things being done very well, even if it looks like it's complicated and complex from a distance. And so my comments are going to be brief, but I think they're going to focus on a couple of things. One is, as the report mentioned, there are authority limitations that the agency has, and there's also resource limitations that we've described to you earlier. Our agency's had an 11% reduction in general fund appropriations, which is 93% of our a source of our funds, and that's been over the course of the last 6 years. And this activity that's been described here as an oversight by the legislative auditor is a discretionary activity. It is an activity that the agency used to do some of in the past, but it is not a mandate like we have with the Wetland Conservation Act, and it is not a large programmatic responsibility like we have with our conservation easement programs. And so as funding goes down and discretionary activities tend to fall by the wayside, and so we don't want to make that an excuse necessarily, but there are some limitations in what we can do, and priorities have to be made, and so we look forward to talking about that in ways we can go forward. But as has been mentioned before, there isn't really a one-size-fits-all approach. Every circumstance, every watershed has got its unique aspects that require different science, different policy. It also depends on what that watershed area is managing for. Some watersheds have a long history of managing for flood control issues. Some have done it to manage stormwater infrastructure needs. And more recently, many have taken on the responsibility of managing for water quality. And you'll hear from some of those organizations yet today, hopefully. The other thing we want to make sure we keep in mind, I think, as we go forward is that there's a balance between state oversight and local ownership. I don't see how we get conservation and clean water accomplished without local ownership. And if the state is going to be overseeing to the point where you have somebody watching someone else do the work, that's just not going to be cost-effective and it's not going to be productive, and the local ownership variable, I think, is going to diminish. So I think we've got to keep that in mind as we go forward. Our local governments are the ones who have land use control, and as the auditor, I think, mentioned, our waters are a reflection of our land uses, and so they have that responsibility, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. They're also the ones that are connected with our constituents, our citizens, and they work with them in small town meetings. They work with them in their own homes sometimes. They are the connection to our citizens, and again, if we have over 70% of our land mass in private ownership, we can't hope to achieve conservation and clean water without working directly with those private landowners. We do believe there are some things we could do more of, given the resources and authorities, and in your packet is a set of principles that our board, who met yesterday, have endorsed as we move forward. One is that when we do oversight, that we do it in a preemptive fashion. As most of you know, that our agency has responsibility to review and approve the plans that local governments develop for managing their water resources. That happens once every 10 years. That's the only regular point at which our agency has a responsibility to get involved. We think a more frequent review of those plans is probably of value. We also want to make sure that the annual reports that we get are reflective of what's going on, but also we would look at trying to come up with ways to identify problems early. We don't expect that problems are always going to be reported to us. We need to go out and look for them and identify them and address them early if, in fact, they are there. Again, most of our local governments have been doing a good job. I think if you know you find a few bad apples in any bushel, and I think certainly the report identified that. And it also identified some success stories, and we think we can do more to have more of them become successful. Being systematic is important. I think that was mentioned by the auditor that, you know, if we do this on a regular basis, they will expect that we will be there. Again, that takes resources to do that. If we're going to have our staff be doing oversight, we have to be make sure that they're not taken away from other priorities. Oversight can also, I think, be done in a productive way if it's constructive, that if we go in there to evaluate a water organization, that we go in there with the goal of building it up to be the best it can be rather than trying to tear it down and, you know, leave it in shambles. I think the goal is to go in there and be very helpful, give them ideas and direction, and if they follow that on a path of success, then we're all the better for it. And those that are already on that path, we don't need to go there so often. We go only to the places where we see problems, at least on a more regular basis. I mentioned the authorities, and I guess I would, you know, tie that to consequences. If you do an oversight endeavor and you find problems, there needs to be some sort of consequences. Otherwise, the endeavor of oversight may not have had much value. And so there are limits right now in the statute. We think a couple of tweaks to that might be worth pursuing in order to provide a means to correct deficiencies. And they should also be proportionate to the deficiency. If it's a large problem, larger consequence. Small problem, you know, smaller consequence. And then the last point that I've heard a lot of in my 4 weeks here talking to people about this issue is that there's an interest in a greater transparency or of what they're doing in their plans and their projects, because there's a number of them, as was described, and they're all a little bit different, and they all have different means of communicating with their citizenry, of doing notices of their endeavors, and so we want to figure out a way to bring more sunshine into that process so they can both invite people into their decision-making as well as explain to others what the value of their work is, and I think that would be a very important part of this oversight endeavor. And then finally, you know, we've not really developed any specific ideas on how this what this would look like, but certainly there are some things that we think are going to be part of it if something moves forward. The first one is that we have to make sure those basic fundamentals of an organization carrying out its work are taken care of. The public notice, the budgeting, the human resource issues have to be fundamentally done well. Otherwise, you're not going to find success in conservation and clean water activities. The second piece that we think is important is that there be coordination done among those many entities. As was described, water does not follow geopolitical boundaries, but on the other hand, there's no hope, I don't hope, of erasing geopolitical boundaries, right? We even talked about the boundary that Minnesota and Wisconsin share that drains into Lake Pepin. Well, we aren't going to annex that area of Wisconsin, I don't believe, and so the same is true at the local level. We've got to figure out a way to manage water across these geopolitical boundaries. And the third thing I'll mention is that each part of our state is quite a bit different. If you've traveled across it, I know most of you have. Our water resource issues vary from one place to another dramatically, and we can't come up with a one-size-fits-all approach that, you know, evaluates every one of them in the same exact way. We need to have some amount of this and never be customized to the local issue. So with that, I will stop and answer any questions you might have, and I'm sure we'll be back at some point down the road to talk more about this topic.
Now, you said you mentioned a couple of tweaks to the statutes. Are you proposing any language, or is that in the works?
Madam Chair, I think it's fair to say it's in the works. Our board met for the first time since the report was issued in late January, and they have given staff the authorization to go ahead and pursue some of those tweaks to policy.
Okay. Do members have questions? Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Jaski, what's your response to the auditor's statement that very few, I believe this is what they said, that very few of the programming with local entities are actually evaluated or reviewed?
Senator Chaudhry,
Mr. Jaski.
I don't know if I reflected that statement accurately from, but I think you're kind of getting the gist of what they're saying and what I'm asking about.
Yeah, I think the way I would answer that, Senator, is that we have programmatic responsibilities for the variety of things that Mr. Thomas reviewed earlier today in our budget presentation. We do that through these grants, and we have conditions on those grants, and we review the proposals, and we review the work that's done under those programs. What the report is really getting at is this more general oversight of how an organization works. And some of those organizations do not get grants from our agency. They're entirely operated with their local sources of funding. And so in those circumstances, we have very limited means to make corrections if, in fact, there are problems. And the example that was given with the one watershed district in central Minnesota, the option was either to terminate them or to keep them going. There were very few other options for the board to make a decision about.
Okay. Then the other question was posed by Mr. Nobles. Why hasn't Bowser provided performance reports for Bowser in the past, and why are we relying on the legislative auditor to do so?
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, as I mentioned earlier, two reasons, I think. One is it's a discretionary activity that the agency could do but isn't mandated to do. That's the first thing. And so as our agency saw budget reductions over the years, we had to take a choice about whether we were going to pursue something that was discretionary or follow through on the mandated programs. And I think the latter was the answer. And secondly, if we were able to go down that path of doing the oversight, the question has to be raised. You get to a point where the oversight is done, and then if there are limited consequences, what was the value of doing that oversight effort in the first place? Because every time you spend an hour, a day, a week on oversight means you're not spending time actually working on a project or a program that is going to get results on the land. So we have to make choices about that balance.
Then another question, last question, I guess, Madam Chair, and looking at Mr. Kramer's letter, he says, on a couple of occasions, the board and I feel that if the system is not broken, why fix it? And then they also say, our present system is working well, so why change it? Do you concur that despite the legislative auditor's report that the current Bowser system is working well, it's not broken?
Mr. Jaski.
Madam Chair and Senator Tedry, I can do concur with that. I will say that there are things that can be done better, and I think those things that the chairman alluded to, I'll let him speak for himself when he gets the opportunity, if he does. But as I said before, it comes down to the resources and the authorities to do those things that the legislative auditor is saying are important, and we do believe that we can accomplish many of those recommendations, again, if we can find the resources and some limited additional authorities to accomplish those recommendations.
Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, my question goes back to the question that was raised
how are we doing? On what basis can Bowser assure us that we are making progress if we do not have statewide data or anything that shows us that we are moving toward the goal for which we are investing all this money?
Mr. Jaskin.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator, as Mr. Thomas showed you in some of the items in our budget presentation, we do track progress towards pollution reduction quite well. The maps that he showed you that indicated reductions in phosphorus and other pollutants, that information is tracked. What this report is getting at really isn't about the conservation results on the land. It's about the systematic oversight of how an organization operates itself. That's the way we interpret that report. Certainly, the report, I think they would acknowledge this, and you can let them speak for themselves, but they looked at this one narrow slice of the agency's responsibilities or program. It did not look at the Wetland Conservation Act program, did not look at the conservation programs. We can show you all kinds of information about the results that have been achieved in those areas over the last many years, and the report did not point out recommendations in those areas. The on-the-ground stuff is not the issue, from what I can tell. It's the systematic evaluation of an organization that is doing the water management activities. And certainly the two are tied. I would acknowledge that. But we've been looking at the results on the land in a much greater way than the actual organizational competencies.
Senator Rummel.
But is there a way of giving us a picture of the where we need to go and how far we are, a statewide picture of how are we getting there?
Madam Chair and Senator, the answer is we believe we can do that. And again, based on our board having met yesterday and authorized us to go and look at some of those ideas, we have some ideas, and we'll be bringing some of them to you very shortly if the opportunity presents itself.
Well, Mr. Jaskin, I think just looking at the summary, it's the auditor is suggesting that you collect performance, financial, and activity data from each entity. Now, to me, that sounds fairly specific and not just broadly about how they're operating as entities, but how they're doing the particular jobs that they're supposed to be doing to keep the waters, protect the waters, prevent flooding. Do you collect any of that information?
Madam Chair, the answer is yes, we do. Mm-hmm. The local governments that get grants from our agency and actually from other agencies are asked and required, I guess, to report those results into a software system we call E-Link, which generates these maps, which does an estimate of the pollution reduction and other benefits that we get from those projects. So the answer is yes, we get the on-the-ground results. The question has to be, I think, more to this report, how are we assessing how the organizations that are doing the work are doing? Are they doing it the most efficiently and effectively they can? And we think we can come up with some ways to evaluate that as well.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. I think we have time for at least, is Ray Bone still here? Yeah. Why don't we take you? And I think we'll probably have to come back to Judy Erickson for the next part when we come back next time. Do you want to go talk to her, Don?
Madam Chair, my name is Ray Bone. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, and to my left is Mark Donay, who is the administrator for the Capital Region Watershed District, and I asked him to come along today to supplement my comments. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to respond to the auditor's report. And a couple of things you have are our formal response in front of you, and in addition to that, you also have this Watershed District Guidebook, and this is something that's kind of hot off the press, something we've been working on since last summer to give folks a better idea of what watershed districts are all about. As perhaps some of you that have watershed districts in your areas will know that, in fact, watershed districts are amongst the best-kept secret in Minnesota. And frankly, I think we do need to increase our visibility, and I think if you get caught up in a snowstorm this next couple of days, take this book home with you and spend some time perusing it, and I think you'll be quite interested in the various activities that we're involved in across the state. The auditor in his report indicated that a couple of statements. To address water issues, Minnesota needs to effectively manage its watersheds. Ideally, surface water should be managed on a watershed basis. We could not agree more with those statements. And I think one of the disappointments with this report from our standpoint is that there was no recommendation from the auditor to address that watershed organizations around the state. You know, we've got right now watershed districts cover about 30% of the state. If you take all the watershed organizations that are out there, include WMOs, you include not-for-profits like Cannon River and Burpee down south, it's about 56% of the state. So there's 44% of the state that's not even covered with any kind of watershed organization. And it seems to me that if you're looking at this issue, that's the first thing that needs to be addressed, is how do we get at organizing these watershed districts or watershed organizations. And I'm not proposing that they all have to be watershed organizations, watershed district organizations. I think they have to be watershed organizations that the locals out there feel comfortable with, whether it be a joint powers, whether it be nonprofits or whatever. But there's got to be some coverage on a watershed basis. And that to us is one of the disappointments with the report. And that being said, I guess what I'd like to do is ask Mark to talk about what watershed districts are about, and we're going to do this as quickly as we can, and I know that you're pressed for time.
Okay, thank you. Again, my name is Mark Donay. I'm the administrator with the Capital Region Watershed District, and welcome to the Capital Region Watershed District. That's where we're located.
Getting a little more water in our yes. watershed today.
We need it. Well, watershed districts are the water quality and flood control experts. We are getting things done, and I think the auditor's report shows that. We're spending tax dollars wisely. Again, the auditor's report showed the median watershed district's using 81% of its funds for implementation activities. We provide public benefit. We're born from citizen petitions. We have citizen advisory committee. We involve citizens. So the publics are benefiting from our projects. We demonstrate accountability, and as others have said, we transcend political boundaries. But it's the accountability topic I want to speak to just briefly. In terms of fiscal accountability, watershed districts submit annual reports and annual audits. If you go to the state auditor's website, you can see a summary of the government funds for every watershed district. I think that's transparency, it's not invisible, and it's accountable. Of course, watershed districts now pretty much all have websites with their own financial data in greater detail. We have public hearings on our budget. We have public notice for our budget hearings. Again, it goes to accountability. Our budgets and annual reports go to the county commissioners that appoint our managers and our cities. Also, our tax levies appear on property tax statements. A high degree of accountability there as well. In terms of accountability to the public, again, we're subject to open meeting law, Data Practices Act, and our affairs are a public matter. In terms of accountability for performance, we perform where no other entities can perform. When it transcends multiple counties and cities, that's when watershed districts are brought in. As the auditor's report showed, 81% of our funds on a median value are put toward implementation. That's performance-based. And, you know, again, I'm not sure how else these impaired waters and TMDLs will be addressed without a functional local unit of government that has the tools, the levy authority, the regulatory authority, and other powers to do these projects. Also, we compel other entities to do cleanup work when, with our rules and regulations, a development will be required to implement water quality practices as well. Just a couple responses to the audit. The audit said there were mixed results. I think as you go through this book on watershed district, obviously we feel the results are not mixed. They're very positive for watershed districts and getting the job done. There's a comment about grants and that watershed districts can levy. Maybe then are not as accountable. I would disagree with that. Again, we levy taxes for much of our funding. I get phone calls from citizens directly saying, what are you doing with our tax dollars? I think that's the highest level of accountability. And the questions about Bowser accountability do not equate to locals not being accountable. I think I've tried to make that point that watershed districts are accountable. The other matter of how Bowser is tracking that, I think, is separate from how we are performing. And I think that's all I have to say at this time.
Well, Madam Chair, we actually would welcome the opportunity to work with Bowser, work with the legislature. If there's more information, you want more accountability from watershed districts, we're more than willing to work with you to get you that. The only caution I would have is don't do it to the degree where you damage the partnership relationship. And as you know, a partnership is a partnership. You know, both groups working together towards a common goal. And frankly, I think water is everybody's responsibility, certainly as much the responsibility of the local units of government as it is the state's. And I think it's in that philosophy that we approach it. You know, it's not a total state responsibility. It's as much our responsibility and the local's responsibility as it is the state's. And if you ever get to the point where it's viewed as being a state responsibility, then you better start adding floors onto the PCA building and the DNR building, because you're going to have to add 300 or 400 staff to get the work done. And I don't think that's not the direction we want to go. You know, I spent 3.5 years on that G16, and the whole purpose of the G16 and the whole policy was pointed towards that partnership between state and locals, and that is a good sound policy, and we ought to stick to that policy because that's how the work's going to get done. Some of these issues the state cannot deal with on a local level, whether it's a drainage issue or cleaning up a specific lake or whatever. Let the locals deal with that. They can deal with their people in a much, much better fashion and get the job done. I don't think an idiot from St. Paul is going to get the job done in some cases. There's got to be that partnership to really, I think, be successful. In terms of the Bowser Board, you know, we believe the Bowser Board is effective. There was some discussion about block voting with the local governments, and I've been around Bowser for 11 or 12 years now, and I've never seen one instance of that, to be honest with you, where there wasn't pretty much consensus on issues. And occasionally there'll be disagreements, but it's certainly not the locals versus the state agencies. I don't think I've ever seen that in that type of or at a Bowser board meeting. We believe the current structure is appropriate. You know, are there some things we can do better, Bowser can do better? Absolutely. And we're willing to work with the legislature, and we're willing to work with Bowser to see that's done. But in the same refrain, I guess I would like to say, there may be some things that local governments need, that we need, that will make us more effective and more efficient as well. And I hope that you would be open to look at some of those ideas that we may have coming down the road.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Bone. And I just would say I don't think the legislative auditor or anybody here is advocating taking away the state-local partnership and the work that we do for managing our waters around the state. I don't think we want to have all our staff coming from St. Paul. I don't think anybody's suggesting anything like that. So I don't want to kind of go down that road we just need to determine if there's ways we can improve the current system.
And Madam Chairman, we would stand ready and willing to work with you on that.
Thank you. Any questions briefly? Members, Judy Erickson really, really wants to respond today. You're willing to wait for 5 more minutes. We could let her get her final. We'll lay Senator Vickerman's bill over. We don't have to do that today. But out of fairness, if members can stay, I think most of us have our later committees are canceled. So if we can just take 5 more minutes, I'd sure appreciate it, members.
Madam Chair, when I look out that window, maybe 5 minutes might be
long to get away.
It might mean the difference between sleeping here and sleeping at home tonight.
Sliding away.
Thank you. Ms. Erickson, I'd suggest you be quick in that spirit.
I will do that. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do appreciate the opportunity to respond today, and since this is all on everyone's mind. And I am with the Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. I just have a couple of comments. Soil and Water Conservation Districts partner with state, federal, and local agencies to deliver conservation on the ground. We are accountable, and we do look forward to working with the legislature and you as we address our water quality and other conservation needs. Soil and Water Conservation Districts, there's 91 of them. They cover the entire state of Minnesota. We work with watershed districts. We partner with counties in a number of areas. In the area of water quality as a measuring stick, it talks about how our water quality is poor. And while we are on the brink, hopefully this session with doing something about restoring and doing something about our poor water quality. I don't think the Clean Water Legacy Act came about as an OLA report on how poorly PCA was doing with water quality. I think the state is now acting and the local governments are ready and to do their part. In terms of accountability and oversight, for soil water districts, we receive a tremendous amount of oversight by the state through our reporting requirements. Our funding comes large part by the state. We have to report back. In some instances, Bowser does withhold our grants. They reward the high-performing districts. They penalize the other districts. So there already are some accountability measures in place, things going on with soil and water districts. We have to do cost-share audits. We have to do all kinds of auditing. Can we do better? Do our folks want to do better at the local level? Yes. And I think Bowser will, working with them, if we can provide them with some additional resources to help our folks be more effective and efficient, help our underperforming districts learn how to do things better and get them up to higher performing, I think our folks would welcome that. We would agree with the funding recommendation with the OLA report for Bowser to have additional resources. Their staff used to meet with our local boards on a regular basis. As Mr. Jaski said, that was discretionary, and that went away. That would be a really a valuable thing to our members. And finally, regards to the Bowser board, we think it's working well. We enjoy our partnership there. We would look forward to working with you on tweaking and finding ways where we can all be better at what we do. But the Bowser board is working well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Any last words? I knew. Senator Chaudhry, I was looking at you. I thought you might have a last word. Go right ahead.
The Watershed Districts Association, I thought it was curious that you made the comment that you were disappointed that the auditor did not recommend that there should be more watershed districts. Is that accurate?
Madam Chairman, no, that really wasn't. My comment was that I believe, based upon the comments that were made by the auditor in his report, that things should be managed. In order to manage water effectively, you have to do it on a watershed basis. He had, it seems to me, a golden opportunity to put forward a recommendation that there should be watershed organizations in each watershed in the state. And right now, my point is that only 56% of all the watersheds in the state are covered by a watershed organization. Now, whether or not those should be watershed districts, joint powers, WMO type, or some other type kind of entity, like a not-for-profit even, like they have in Cannon Falls, for example. It's a very good watershed organization. That would be up to, seem to me, that be best to leave that up to the locals to decide how they want to do it. But I think a critical opportunity was lost in not making that recommendation to the legislature.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Bone, why wouldn't the Association of Watershed Districts be active already in creating watershed organizations in all the districts? What's the point of the legislative auditor recommending that?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I imagine they would recommend that if they were to audit the Association of Watershed Districts. But I guess the question is, why wouldn't your association already be active in creating those organizations?
Madam Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, we are active in doing that. And whenever we get a request from the local level to come out and talk about watershed districts, we respond to those requests. We're in the process of establishing a watershed district right now. Bowser is down in Mower, Steele, and I believe Freeborn County. So that's happening. But again, Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, we don't believe it's appropriate for us to go into every watershed and say you need a watershed district. But certainly we can and do advocate for watershed organizations.
I'm hearing a lot of a common theme, Madam Chair, that we're not doing something because we haven't been asked or we haven't been required to. And
well,
I think the legislative auditor is recommending that we require them to do certain things.
I think it's good food for thought, and we should continue to this discussion. See. where it goes, where it takes us. But it's, I think it's very helpful to get these ideas on the table, and we should take them seriously.
I tell you, Madam Chair, in 10 years I've been I've heard a lot of audit reports. I've never heard Jim Nobles so passionate in any of his testimony.
Members, we, as you probably know, we have a meeting scheduled for tomorrow morning with public testimony, and it's an effort to get all the people who haven't had a chance yet to give us feedback after going through the entire governor's budget. We haven't made a final decision yet about tomorrow. it seems like there's a fairly good chance we will have to cancel it. But I guess I'd kind of like to monitor the weather a little bit. So, members, I'm not sure if you're all going home, trying to go home tonight. I mean, those who are close by are, but I don't know about the rural members if you're going to be in town. So is there an easy way to notify you, or can you just check with Mr. Jurovsky?
How do we do that?
Madam Chair, just members, I could put an announcement once the chair decides. I could put an announcement on my voicemail here at work, and you could call my number, which is 296-1767. And then I also would send an email to everybody. That would include the public too. But I just don't know if you're all on your work email in your apartments, like for the people who maintain apartments near the
Capitol.
Madam Chair,
what was that number again?
It's 296-1767. So that's Mr. Jurovsky's direct number. And also, you know, he'll send an email out, and we'll have it on our committee listserv for all the public members who are members of the public that get that list. I'd just as soon wait a couple of hours just to get more accurate information before we know for sure. And if all the schools are going to be closed and the Capitol is going to be closed, then I think you can assume we will not be here.
How late are you going to be here? I'm going to be here at 9. I need to know before I go to bed tonight.
So. Right. Yeah, I think we need to make a decision tonight, although it would be nice to know if the schools are going to be closed. We'll try to make a decision tonight before too late.
Can I call this number? Because I don't have any way to get a message where my apartment is.
Okay. And you don't have email. Yeah, why don't you call?
I'll call.
Yeah, we'll just have to do it within a couple of hours so members can make plans. Thank you. The meeting's adjourned.